Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. These days, the World Health Organization tracks infectious disease outbreaks around the world, at times mounting the response needed to protect populations from the consequences of epidemics. Today, we're talking about the history of epidemics, pandemics, plagues, and outbreaks of infectious diseases, how they start and how they have ended, and how an epidemic affects a culture. Coming up later, we'll hear from the executive producer of a theater and ballet production rooted in Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Mask of the Red Death. Joining us now by phone from Vermont is historian and author of Plagues in World History, John Aberth. Welcome.
Thanks, Ann.
And with us in the studio is Ohio State University infectious disease specialist, Dr. Amber Vasquez. Welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Vasquez, how does an epidemic start?
Well, it really depends on what the epidemic is. I mean, epidemics can be caused by bacteria, viruses, parasites, and you have to start with a susceptible population. And so, for example, if you have a bunch of people who have been immunized against a particular virus, then you're not going to probably have an epidemic that's going to break out there because you have a lot of people who have immunity against that disease. And that's the idea of herd immunity. You vaccinate a bunch of people, you can help prevent the spread of the disease if greater than 95% of people have been immunized against that particular pathogen. And so it starts with a set of population who can get the disease, and then it's really the mode of transmission after that. So if you have, epidemics and pandemics, the reason we talk about influenza epidemics and influenza pandemics is because influenza is spread so easily. It's spread by a respiratory droplet. You know, you can cough or sneeze, and it spreads to the person just a few feet away from you. It can be spread indirectly via respiratory droplets. You can get it kind of on your hands and, certain surfaces, and those surfaces become fomites. Basically, you touch an elevator button after you've just sneezed into your hand, and then somebody else comes on, touches that same elevator button, and then touches their face, and then this is propagating, further and further. And that's typically how pandemics just spread. And it's been a bit of a media talking point about the globalization of the world now,
with the transportation systems we have.
Exactly, you can be in Africa and you can pick up an infectious disease there. There will be an incubation period, and that's one of the very key things about an epidemic or a pandemic, is there's an incubation period where you aren't sick yet, and you can transport yourself. You can hop on a plane, go over to, there's a, you know, a, an Ebola or a Lassa fever, hemorrhagic fever, epidemic going on in West Africa. Somebody hops on a plane, they come over to the United States, and after a couple of days of being here, they weren't exposed to it but 10 days ago, but now they're getting symptoms, and all of a sudden that's transported itself to a new continent. And so that's how pandemics start to spread. Epidemics are focused mostly to a particular area,
okay,
a smaller area, just maybe say the state of Ohio or something, but pandemics are worldwide.
So, John Aberth, back in the day, going back in history, the first epidemics didn't turn into pandemics, I gather.
They did as far as was possible with the transportation system of the time. The Black Death of the mid-14th century was one example. It is thought that it originated in Asia and then spread across the trade routes of the Mongol Empire to Europe. It probably didn't reach the New World because Columbus hadn't discovered it yet, but it spread as far as it was possible to go with the transportation methods that were available at the time. And the 1918 influenza epidemic did travel all around the world because, of course, by then you had steamship travel, which was able to transport it.
So, Dr. Vasquez, how does an epidemic end?
Wow. it's certainly different now. If we're talking about the Black Death, I'm not sure we really know how that pandemic ended. or other various epidemics that perhaps just run their course.
There are some ideas about how it ended, but
Yeah. Sometimes it's, there's a question of maybe improved hygiene. People just flee from the area, quarantining of individuals, or is it just running its course through Europe?
They just kill everybody it can.
It infects everybody it can. And then those people who are susceptible, they either live or they die. And then it runs its course. So I'm not sure it's... We totally know at that time. Now, for the most part, because we understand pathogens better and we know what causes diseases, we know how they spread, and thus we know how to prevent them. Improved infection control is really the key. And that can be different for whatever pathogen you're talking about. If we're talking about Ebola, then that spreads via infected secretions, bodily secretions from an infected patient. So infected blood, urine, sweat, what have you. And in a resource poor country like Guinea, where they have, or Liberia, where they have the current outbreak, it's very difficult to have the standard precautions that we expect here in the United States, where needles are clean, there's no exchange, there's no contact, healthcare worker contact with exposed bodily secretions from an infected patient. All those things are expected in the United States. They may not be present in some of these, very poor countries. And so that's when specialists like the WHO go in and they sort of take control and they do a lot of contact, tracing, find a patient who's infected, who are those contacts, isolate those contacts. And then follow them for symptoms. If there is an immunization, which there's not for Ebola, but certainly with other epidemics, this would be the case, try to immunize those people and those surrounding people and just try to blanket everybody in immunization if you possibly can. But it really depends on the source of the epidemic.
John Aberth, what are some of the theories about how the Black Death ended?
I should just point out that one of the interesting things that has been discovered by new techniques of paleomicrobiology is they've been able to isolate the DNA of Yersinia pestis, the bacterium that causes plague, from the dental pulp of victims of the Black Death. And what they found, they've even reconstructed a complete genome or DNA sequence. What they found is that these were new strains that emerged perhaps in the 13th century or early 14th century. But then they are the ancestor for all modern strains of plague. So the plague that we have today is almost very genetically similar to the plague of the Black Death. It seems that is the plague that we have today is just as virulent as it was then. So in order to explain how it disappeared, we can't rely on genetic mutations or anything like that because the DNA has been found to be so similar, so we have to rely on the things that Amber talked about, perhaps quarantine, rats became immune to the disease.
So they weren't spreading it?
Well, when rats become immune, they don't die. So when rats don't die, the fleas stay on the rat and continue to feed on the rat. The bubonic plague is spread by fleas. That, once the rat dies, they search for a new host.
Gotcha.
And then they bite humans and spread the disease to humans. So if the rats aren't dying, then the fleas aren't jumping onto humans and spreading the disease to humans.
And Amber Vasquez, to what extent, when you study epidemiology, are you studying human behavior?
Oh, it's critical. It's always a factor. And this is one of the wonderful things about infectious diseases, communicable diseases, and epidemiology in general, is that it's so tied into public health. And human behavior is tied into public health. And so the behaviors of people, if we're talking about, some of the epidemics from, the 1800s, yellow fever, their travel habits, what sort of, sanitation they're living in, how hygienic are their surroundings. And so, there's a lot of epidemics that have surrounded just particular behavior in terms of people surrounding a particular water supply. And if you're looking at that, you just look at what people are around the particular supply of the infection, you know, that's spreading throughout the community. And you can examine that kind of behavior. So some of that behavior is innocuous. Some of it is actually, you know, there's so many different, you know, HIV is now a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And so if we're talking about human behavior, then that's very critical in terms of, you know, HIV's spread because of unprotected sexual contact. And so that, you know, what sort of animals have people been exposed to? What have they been eating? Where have they been? What do they do for work? These are all questions that when I'm evaluating any sort of an infectious disease, and certainly is also seen in the larger context, all those questions get asked is basically, what is your lifestyle like? And it's always fun.
John Eberth, Amber Vasquez and I were talking earlier about how the study of epidemiology, the study of all of this, is like the studying the history of the world.
Yeah, it's, you know, one of the interesting things they've been able to do is to reconstruct the genome of these ancient pathogens. But in the case of the 1918 influenza virus, for example, they were able to recover this from two young soldiers that died in September 1918, and an Inuit woman from Alaska. And what they discovered was that, you know, this particular strain, it's called H1N1, this particular strain of influenza virus was uniquely virulent because it was able to rapidly reproduce inside the lungs as much as several thousand times faster than a normal influenza virus. So it then provoked a uncontrolled immune response, something known as a cytokine storm, that, you know, affected especially young, healthy individuals. And usually influenza targets the very young or the very old. But in this case, it targeted especially very young, healthy individuals, which you wouldn't expect. And because it provoked this immune response, their lungs then filled with fluid and they died. And this is very similar to the Black Death, too. The Black Death affected all age groups in what is called a catastrophic mortality pattern, which is opposed to the attritional mortality pattern, in which typically death affects only the very young or the very old in populations. So when that happens, you know, then the population is greatly affected because the ones that reproduce in society are the ones that are healthy and that are typically between the ages of 15 and 40. So when that happens, then the society is in danger of perhaps dying out if the disease, you know, affects it in numerous epidemics or pandemics of that nature.
My guests are Dr. Amber Vasquez. She's an OSU infectious disease specialist and also historian and author of Plagues in World History, John Eberth. We're talking about what we know about how plagues and epidemics, pandemics, how they spread, and how they change culture. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about the history of epidemics, pandemics, plagues, and outbreaks of other infectious diseases, how they start and how they have ended, and how an epidemic affects a culture. Coming up later, we'll hear from the executive producer of the Shadowbox Theater and Ballet production rooted in Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Mask of the Red Death. Still with us by phone from Vermont is historian and author of Plagues in World History, John Eberth, and with us in the studio, Dr. Amber Vasquez of OSU's Department of Infectious Diseases. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. 8513. As of last week, 339 mumps cases have been linked to the Franklin, Delaware, and Madison counties community outbreak of mumps. Of those, 199 cases have been linked to the OSU outbreak. Most people don't know anyone affected by the outbreak, though. How does a personal connection play into how the public reacts to news of an outbreak, Amber?
Well, in this particular case of mumps, you know, I think that that for the most part, mumps is it's not that severe of an illness when you get it.
Mm-hmm.
People are pretty miserable. I mean, you get an upper respiratory kind of infection, cold type symptoms, but then the neck starts to swell and, you know, high fevers. And rarely you can get complications such as deafness and sterility in men because of swelling of the testicles. But for the most part, I think because it's a mild illness in general, I think most people don't get that excited about it. And also, there's probably a lot of people who don't realize that they've been in contact with somebody because a lot of people just have cold symptoms. And not everybody manifests the symptoms of neck swelling.
So then why do we worry about it?
Well, we worry about it on the grander scheme, really. Well, I mean, there are rare people. I'm sure the person, you know, there is at least one person that I knew of that has some sort of deafness
mm-hmm.
Related to their mumps illness. And so when you talk about, you know, concern about things, the vast majority of people are not going to have that severe of an illness. But when it is severe, it can change the rest of your life in some manner if you're sterile or deaf because you were ill from something that was preventable. And that's really the key, is that there's a lot of hysteria that's been built up over the last 15, 20 years because of the anti-vaccination campaign and concerns about the MMR vaccine, the mumps, measles, rubella vaccine. And they were very unfounded, and but nevertheless, the damage was done. And so, you know, a lot of people, they say, look, I'm more worried about autism, which has not been proven to be linked to vaccinations. I'm more worried about that than I am about getting mumps because nobody gets the mumps. Mm-hmm. It's rare and nobody dies of it. Well, there are other things that are very vaccine preventable that people can die of. Children can die of measles. A lot of children have historically died of that. And now we're seeing a resurgence of measles. We have an outbreak of that, you know, mm-hmm. in our surrounding counties. And pertussis. I mean, just
the whooping cough.
Yeah, the whooping cough. Watch a child suffer through a whooping cough, and you know, and to know that a safe, effective vaccine is available to prevent that. That's why we care about this so much.
John Aberth, have our standards for danger changed over time as modern technology and science met its match in this fast populating world that's also become smaller with changing transportation? Was there a day when the mumps would have been viewed with more fear?
Well, I think we've been able to track these outbreaks a lot more successfully with modern technology, especially with the World Health Organization, and especially after 9/11, we got certainly more sophisticated in being able to track those. And so we're able to communicate a lot better than back in the Middle Ages, for example, which is my field of specialty. I mean, one of the frightening things about the Black Death was that people didn't really know when it was going to come and how it was going to come. It was very mysterious. So when you don't know about something, that's when you have the most fear, you know, when you're ignorant about its cause or about its methods. So I think that would have caused the most anxiety, is not knowing when it might come, and we're able to track that information a lot more successfully. And of course, we also have antibiotics, we have vaccines, as Amber mentioned, so we're able to protect ourselves in a way that we weren't able to do back in the past, and that's a big advantage too.
Yeah, I also think when you were talking about ignorance, in a way, it's we are lacking the memory of these illnesses. A lot of the people who don't want to vaccinate their children or don't want to get themselves vaccinated, it's despite the fact that we have knowledge of these pathogens and we understand how they're spread, we know how to treat them, if we have a treatment for them, which a lot of these vaccine preventable illnesses, we do not. They just have to run their course and you just have to hope, and you have to manage the symptoms and hope that you don't have complications from it. But nevertheless, over time, as we've eliminated these diseases through immunization, we've eliminated the memory of them, and we've eliminated the fear of them. And
yeah, that happened with smallpox, especially.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, it's the case with, I mean, a child is miserable when they have measles and when they have whooping cough. And it's, or polio for that matter. And, you know, there's tons of things that we're starting to see back now, and people are going to have to start getting familiar with them and developing a new kind of fear with, you know, in the context of understanding that the scientific evidence certainly weighs towards the fact that there is no known link between any sort of neurologic illness in children, such as autism, with any of the vaccines.
Mm-hmm. How much do you credit the anti-vaccine movement for any of these outbreaks?
Well, a number of them can, I can't speak to every single one of them,
sure.
But a number of them, they link directly. Our measles outbreak, currently right up in just a couple of counties around Columbus, is in an Amish community, unimmunized. They recently took a trip to the Philippines, where there is currently an outbreak of about 20,000 cases of measles. And so basically, they brought measles back with them. And the reason that they did is because they were not vaccinated. The MMR vaccine is 97 or 98% effective at preventing measles. And so if you get vaccinated, you know, that's pretty much all you need to prevent measles. And so that's the there was a case of measles, an outbreak in New York City. And I think that was there was the outbreak in the UK last year, which I think is on the waning side. But there were thousands of cases in the UK last year and people coming back causing outbreaks here. And they'd recently traveled. It's a young child. It's an 11-year-old that recently just traveled to the United Kingdom. And they come back and now there's an outbreak.
You're listening go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to point out this vaccination debate goes back to 1976 when we had a swine flu outbreak under President Ford and, and then under President Carter. And there was an attempt to vaccinate and there was fears about Guillain-Barré syndrome. So this debate, goes back quite a long ways.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about epidemics, plagues, pandemics, how they start, how they end, and how they've changed our culture. Give us a call if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. So, John Aberth, how did the Black Death, what do we know about how the Black Death changed culture?
Well, that's a very big question, I think it changed culture in so many different ways. One of the things I've been investigating is its impact upon medicine. And I argue that it actually introduced a new theory in medicine, which I call the poison thesis, that plague was viewed as a kind of poison that invades the body from outside, instead of the humoral theory, which explained disease internally as a balance of the four humors of the body. So this poison acts by its whole substance, which means that it acts independently of any individual predisposition to disease. So this was quite a different approach in terms of medical concepts of disease, and it implied different approaches to cures. For example, the way to treat poison is by drug therapy, which is what we use today with antibiotics. So it anticipates, in some respects, the germ theory of modern times. Another thing that happened, of course, was that with the death of so many people, you had laborers able to negotiate for higher wages. And this really improved living standards for much of the peasantry throughout Europe, so that their living standards improved. And, eventually the whole manorial system of feudalism died out because lords were simply not able to, keep farming the land directly with labor, and they were really forced to pay them wages instead, which is basically the wage system instead of the serfdom system. So it did inaugurate some big changes, and it also affected mentalities. Of course, death became a lot more present. in people's minds because the plague kept coming back periodically, once a decade throughout the rest of the 14th and 15th centuries. It kept populations low until about the end of the Middle Ages. Population was never able to really recover because of these periodic outbreaks, even though people might have been living healthier or better. So it really impacted society in many ways.
And what do you know about what impact it had on royalty and leadership? Was it non-discriminating, or were they able to protect themselves better by isolation or however?
Yeah, I mean, the indications are that the upper classes had far lower mortality rates. For example, the one source, the Inquisition's postmortem, which records death among the barony, or, you know, the nobles who held their land of the king, about 200 persons, they had about a 25% death rate. Whereas normally among the peasant population, the vast majority of the people, death rate was about 50 to 60%. So they had far lower death rates, and that's probably because they were able to isolate themselves better from society. They were able to retreat to their country estates or their manors. So they were able to escape wherever the plague was because they had that mobility. Doctors, you know, regularly advised to flee the plague, and that does seem to have worked during the third pandemic in India at the turn of the 20th century, when Indian populations would simply leave their village when the plague struck, and that was fairly effective. And of course, they also had better living standards at the time. They lived in stone houses or castles, which probably were infested with fewer rats and fleas. They probably had better hygiene and better general overall health because of their better diet.
We often hear that another pandemic is inevitable eventually, something like the influenza of 1918. Is this a mathematical calculation or something even more complex, Amber Vasquez?
Well, I think it's very complicated. It's partly, I'm not sure if there's a mathematical calculation per se, like an actual algorithm or some sort of equation to actually calculate that out, but none that I know of. But in general, it's more of, you know, with what we understand about how some of these diseases work and how our immunity works, it's inevitable. And this is why the H1N1 influenza pandemic of 2009 was so concerning, is because when it arrived, it was a novel strain of the virus, meaning that nobody had had exposure to that particular virus. And in that setting, again, going back to what we first talked about, that means that potentially almost everybody is susceptible. And that's when you get concerned about a pandemic. So in the wake of the terrorist attacks, you know, we're looking at, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether or not we should destroy our two remaining stockpiles of smallpox, which is in Atlanta and in Russia. And I think that question is arising again. It's
why
never
do
really
keep
gone
a
away.
Stockpile of smallpox?
Well, there's a couple of articles that have been written trying to defend it, which is that the vaccine that we have a vaccine, obviously. That's how we eradicated smallpox to begin with, was mass vaccination. But the vaccine is not that great. It's sort of miserable to receive. And the way they see it is, not only can we do more work to try to develop a better vaccine should this virus arise again, but also there's a lot to learn from the smallpox virus in general with regards to other diseases. Mm-hmm. And so they just feel there's a lot of research left to be done. However, the concern is that this has been gone for 30 plus years. It was officially declared eradicated in 1980, and we still have these stockpiles. Nobody has, you know, the layperson hasn't seen any practical applications of continuing those things other than the rumblings of concern that a terrorist could get a hold of it, or that, you know, somebody, just a lab worker, could accidentally mishandle it. You know, it doesn't have to be intentional. It could be unintentional. You can
Thanks
get
to Stephen
infection.
King. That's always my fear.
Could I make
sure.
a comment?
Yes, John Aberth.
Yeah. You know, there have been a lot of apocalyptic scenarios that have been put forth, such as by Lori Garrett or Richard Preston, author of The Hot Zone and so forth. But I'm actually more hopeful about our future with these kinds of pandemics. I think we demonstrated with the 2009 influenza pandemic that Amber mentioned, and also with SARS, that we're able to effectively isolate these outbreaks with the sharing of information that we're able to achieve, especially after 9/11, and with the more sophisticated information technology wielded by the WHO. So, I think there always will be threats and possible outbreaks, but we need to be flexible and we need to be aware. And we need to share information. That's the most crucial thing, especially with regard to avian flu, which originates in China. We need to be able to share information quickly and effectively.
Yeah, I would agree. And two things. One is that I would say the cooperation, global cooperation, is critical. That's how smallpox was eradicated. It's one of the reasons why polio is taking some steps back. They there was the feeling that we could... or at least there is still currently the active attempt to fully eradicate polio, because humans are the only known reservoir for that disease. And so if we can immunize against it, then we can eradicate it the way we did smallpox. But there's a lot of distrust in the area, in places like the Middle East and that, where you're starting to see it. It had been contained to about three or four different countries, and now it's starting to spread back into two or three others just in the last, 5 months of this year. So, the global cooperation is critical. The other is that I would actually consider it, I'm a little frustrated sometimes, because there's a lot of popular concern about things like these, like MERS and Ebola. And, oh my gosh, there's going to be a zombie apocalypse or whatnot, when there's actually really critical concerns going on underneath it that a lot of people aren't quite aware of. Things like drug-resistant organisms, which is probably the biggest threat from an infectious disease standpoint to the population at large, that we are just burning through the treatments that we have.
The antibiotics are becoming...
The bacteria are becoming resistant to the antibiotics,
right,
through repeated exposure. And then those things, there can be cross transmission of those things. It doesn't spread the way something like flu does. It's not that communicable. And these have primarily been nosocomial spread, meaning they're hospital based spread. But it's the reason why MRSA became prominent, and now MRSA is spread through the community. And if these other types of organisms that a lot of people aren't quite aware of start to spread, more rapidly. And just in the last 10 years, they've become more prominent. They're still not that common, but we see them at Ohio State. A lot of hospitals see them. And they're very scary, because in some cases, we have absolutely no antibiotic to treat it.
That's also the case with drug-resistant tuberculosis. So you're seeing a resurgence of that, even though it's usually thought of as a 19th century disease of the Romantic poets. But it's recurring because of this drug resistance.
John Aberth, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Ed.
John Aberth, he's a historian and author of Plagues in World History. And also, Dr. Amber Vasquez, thank you as well.
It was my pleasure.
Dr. Amber Vasquez, she's an OSU infectious disease specialist. Coming up, we're going to turn more to the culture of the plague and how it has affected at least one writer. That would be Edgar Allan Poe. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Today we're talking about the history of epidemics, pandemics, plagues, and outbreaks of all manner of infectious disease, how they start, how they end, and how an epidemic affects a culture. Joining us now is the executive producer and lead composer of a Shadowbox theater and ballet production rooted in Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Mask of the Red Death. The work is entitled The Mask, and with me in the studio, Steve Geyer. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Thank you.
Now, the music we were just listening to is from the show.
Yes, yes. The show is, think of it as eight stories entirely by Poe, with The Mask being the overarching story. In The Mask, the noblemen of the country are sequestered in the castellated abbey of Prince Prospero. And within that abbey, they decide that they're going to have a masked ball, to celebrate their ability to escape from the scourge. And the room that the ball is contained in has seven different segments, and each segment is a different color. And what we've done is we've taken seven other pieces from Poe and placed one inside each room. And the piece you were listening to just now was from The Raven.
How does the arc of a plague work as a larger theme in this production?
Well, again, within the original Poe story, you have the mask of the Red Death, and that character, the mummer, which is Red Death, shows up at the very top of the story, and Prospero sees him from across the room and is enraged that someone would wear such a ridiculous and inappropriate costume to the ball. And so he begins to approach the mummer and then realizes partway there, maybe I should take my time with this. And there becomes this very long and extended set of experiences. And what we do then is we take that extended set of experiences and work through seven other Poe pieces until finally at the end you have the denouement in the black room, which for us is also the pit and the pendulum.
My guest is Steve Geyer. He's the executive producer and lead composer of a Shadowbox Theater production. It's called The Mask. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What do you know about what Poe knew about the plague and what he was writing about?
There are some interesting things that may have been at play here. First of all, Poe's wife, Virginia, was suffering from tuberculosis at the time he wrote Mask of the Red Death. In addition to that, he lost his mother, Eliza, his brother, William, and his foster mother, Frances Allen, all to TB. So it's certainly at least possible that that was part of what was on his mind. You know, the frothing, bloody sputum is part of that issue. So I think that's at least one possibility. It's also possible, because in his piece, Everything Ends in the Black Room, that he might have been referring to the bubonic plague, the Black Death. It's difficult to know, of course, but those seem to be things that were important in his life and that he was aware of, certainly, that he might have been referring to.
How did you project the mood of the plague outside? Was there a sense of what was going on outside Prospero's castle?
Yes. What we've done in this piece, since it's a ballet, we have the luxury of using dancers. We're working with Verb Ballets out of Cleveland,
right,
and they're providing the core of extraordinary ballet dancers. Shadowbox, on the other hand, is providing what are called supers, the folks that just kind of add to the scene. We have lots of dying and dead supers,
okay,
that are outside the castle walls. As the piece progresses, they actually, even the nobles inside, start to die off. And we're able, with the bodies that we have at our disposal, to kind of let the audience in on precisely what was happening in Poe's mind as he wrote that story.
Why the joining of the theater and the ballet? How did that help you express
the
message?
A few years ago, we got a call from Sherry Mitchell at Ballet Met and worked with Gerard Charles, who was the artistic director at the time, to put together Seven Deadly Sins. It was a wonderful collaborative opportunity for us, and it gave us the ability to say some things musically and theatrically that we couldn't say on our own, or at least didn't think we could.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided after that particular production, we spoke again with Gerard and said, hey, we should do this again. And he suggested maybe something with a Halloweenish theme. So we all put our hats on and came up with this notion about Poe. And then Gerard left and went to the Joffrey in Chicago. And the Ballymet was without an artistic director for a while. So that was, we had just completed the piece and we were casting about for something to do with it. And the folks at the Verb Ballets, Dr. Margaret Carlson, happened to hear about the show and come and listen to the music, decided it would be worth a shot. And we went to Cleveland then and did the show up there. Wonderful, wonderful success. And for us, the opportunity to express what we hear musically in a visual state is what it's all about. That ability to take media in many forms and make it work. In addition, collaborating with massively talented people is a joy. Not only do you get to express whatever you have to say, but you get to understand what they have to say. And it's so incredibly informative. And each process after that is informed by what you've learned and by the new relationships you have. It's really a wonderful thing.
How has the production changed from its inception to actually putting it on the stage?
Well, when you first conceive of something like this, it's nothing but a fantasy.
Yeah.
And you think you know what it is you're going to do, and you make grand plans and you write it all out. And then it's nothing at all like that, because you, as you begin to, in our case, write the music, which is descriptive of each of the stories, the music takes on a life of its own. And you begin to go through the process of following the music to some degree, and then following the muse and trying to decide which is most important in any given moment. And so during a lot of our songwriting sessions, I was reading passages from Poe, mm-hmm. to kind of keep everybody on track.
To keep the mood going.
That's exactly right. Because with Poe in particular, the mood is everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, we had to write in a way that if we played a song, we would, you know, pray that somebody would be able to say, yeah, I kind of get that. That sounds like maybe an Edgar Allan Poe piece. Maybe it's from The Raven. You know, that's obviously the ultimate fantasy.
Uh-huh.
But certainly you want it to be close enough that when you give it to a choreographer and say, all right, here's the story this came from. Here's the music. I hope you think they work together. So you get feedback at that point, and you begin to discover that, okay, some things work really, really well, and other things need a little help. Because in our fantasy, we understood it, but in their understanding of the story, it doesn't make sense. So you begin to tweak again, getting the music a little closer to what the choreographer understands. Then you put it on stage, and then everybody kind of gets into that game of saying, well, I understand what this is saying musically, but I'm not sure what this movement has to do with this story. And it becomes this great ballet of its own, this trading back and forth of, okay, who gets to win in this moment? With the goal, of course, being what's the most effective story we can tell.
How creepy is it?
Well, there are moments that are extremely creepy. No question about it. Amy Lay from Shadowbox is playing the role of the Red Death. And we have kind of chosen to depict that as very, very sinuous and very, very overbearing and exceedingly elegant. Not the way you really think about infectious diseases, but it's incredibly creepy because you get right off the bat that this person, this creature, has an evil intent, and that every movement is fraught with danger, and the potential for death and destruction is there whenever she's on stage. And of course, a lot of the other stories, you know, The Pit and the Pendulum is just top to bottom creepy.
Well, if you grow up with Vincent Price,
exactly,
it's just it really just gives me the complete creeps to think about it. That was the era that I grew up, but I don't even know if you can find those movies anymore.
Oh, they're on YouTube. We watch them.
Did that help?
Absolutely. You know, every single time you watch an interpretation, you learn something new, because when we read or experience something on our own, we have a very clear idea of what it meant to us. And then if you're open to the process and you hear or see somebody else experience it, then you begin to understand, oh, well, they've taken something a little different away from it. And it just opens additional doors, at least from the perspective of songwriting or choreography. When you're looking for all the doors that can possibly be opened, you really want to know what other people had to say.
We were talking about this earlier with Dr. Amber Vasquez at OSU's infectious disease. She's an infectious disease specialist at OSU. And we were talking about it in terms of vaccines and so forth, and why people don't get vaccinated and why they feel comfortable not getting vaccinated. And one of the reasons she said was that, well, we don't have a memory, and we don't have a collective memory or an individual memory of what these diseases can do when they you know, when they're unchecked.
Right.
And I was wondering about, so we don't really have a cultural memory of the plague per se. How did you, was it from going to these all these different sources help invoke that?
It was absolutely.
Fear?
I mean, there were a couple of things in my world that contributed to this. My father had scarlet fever when he was young, and it damaged his heart. Mm-hmm. And he ended up having a valve replaced in 1963. I mean, it changed his entire life. And I had a teacher who was very important to me, who walked in braces and crutches because he had polio when he was a child. And I personally had some things that made me wary and gave me a small understanding of perhaps what the world was like, what the fear was like. I mean, I very clearly remember seeing iron lungs when I was a kid.
Yep.
And I really thought that must be the worst thing ever. I'm sure it's not, but it seemed like the worst thing ever. And knowing that polio was out there and potential, you know, when we were kids, the idea of being vaccinated was the best thing in the world. Even if there had been some risk associated with it, which there's not, but if there had been, it wouldn't have made any difference because the fear of the diseases that you were vaccinating against was so high that it was clearly worth the small risk that was associated. So we used that in my personal understanding, and then again looking at this additional source material. And understanding some of what was happening with the plagues themselves. There's been a lot of great fiction written during those times that gives you a pretty powerful sense of the fear and the way it changed everything about life and culture.
The use of masks, of course, was necessary in the production. How does the mask pose a challenge to actors?
Well, it's obviously all about mime and dance when you're wearing a mask, because as humans, we pick up so many cues from what's going on with the face. And you take that out of the equation, and all of a sudden, there's a really different sort of experience happening. One of the cheats that we used in our production is by taking people out of the ball itself and into each of the individual rooms, we're able to say, okay, the masks can come off for a while. We'll tell this different story. It's great because for an audience to see a show where everyone's in a mask for 2 hours would get tough.
It's hard on the audience.
It's terribly difficult for the audience because you're asking them to do a kind of interpretation through dance and mime that we don't do normally. And in the interaction between performer and audience member, what you're really trying to do is take as much conscious thought away from them as you can so that their process is to sit back and just absorb the way they do in normal life. If somebody has to turn to their table or seatmate and say, "What was that all about?" you've lost them for that moment at least. Mm-hmm. So you have to be careful and thoughtful. You can make shows really deep and really intense, but there's a point beyond which, if you go, you've lost their attention.
Tell me about the progression of the Poe stories within the mask. How did you decide the order?
Well, that was an interesting conversation because, you know, when you write music, you sort of have this notion in your head from the word go about how that CD and in my world the album is gonna sound, and so you lay it out that way, and then when you're thinking about a show, though, all of a sudden that goes right out the window because there are so many other kinds of considerations. There's the development of the story because you want there to be an arc and you want there to be a climax and a small, you know, coming down from that climax to the end of the show. You also have to be thoughtful about scene and set changes and costume changes, and there's a million
the logistics.
Things. Yeah, and logistics are such a big deal with theater and ballet that was an important part of our thought process. So we basically laid it out according to the idea of the story arc, and then we made changes based on what was going on with the choreography. When we did the show in Cleveland, for example, the fall of the House of Usher was in the middle of the first act, but the piece that they had created for it was so spectacular that we ended up shifting some things around so we could make it the close of the first act. Okay. Because it was just impossible to follow. So you learn that as you go.
Yeah. Well, Steve Geyer, I want to thank you for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Steve Geyer, he's the executive producer and lead composer of Shadowbox Theater and Verb Ballet production, rooted in Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Mask of the Red Death. It's called The Mask. It's one night only at the Palace Theater. For more information, you can go to the link on our website at WOSU.org. And you will close the show with some music from The Mask. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.